Welcome, my friends. I am Vivian McPeak, and this is Hemp Present. If you have feedback or would like to suggest a guest or topic for Hemp Present, email me at hemppresent@gmail.com. My guest today is Leonora, or Leo, Russell, who is a licensed mental health therapist and chemical dependency professional. Leo is also the executive director of Entheo Society, a 501c3 nonprofit organization focused on providing education and community regarding entheogenic culture. She is currently the chair of the initiative PAC Adapt Washington, which is working to get legal psilocybin on the ballot in Washington 2026. She's the chair of the Adapt Therapeutic Psilocybin Bill effort, aiming for the next Washington State legislative session in 2025. And I've asked Leo to come back to Hemp Present to tell us about all of that and more. Welcome back, Leo, to Cannabis Radio.
Thank you so much, Vivian.
My pleasure. It's always great. I have so much respect for you as an organizer. Leo, you are a chemical dependency professional, which is a very important role in society, especially a society experiencing a widespread addiction crisis. Before we dive into the details of your work and advocacy, can you touch on what led you to that field of work, why you were drawn to the field of chemical dependency?
Yeah, I mean, I had started out doing social service work, and then I made my way into getting my license as a therapist. And then I found my way into government doing kind of CPS work, but a lot of work with indigenous populations. I worked with Family Treatment Court. That was a pilot project with King County to address parents with addiction issues whose kids are in the system. And it's seen as a productive and kind of holistic methodology for moving forward with placements of kids in the CPS system. And trying to look at addiction from different perspectives, but I had this ongoing interest in kind of indigenous perspectives and working with people of color and stuff like that. And I found myself dealing primarily with addicts as clients. And then I think I just found at some point that I wanted more education. I wanted more skills, more tools in my tool belt. I went back to school to get the training to be a certified chemical dependency professional. I did my training at Seattle Indian Health Board, which is a very 12-step based program, really based in kind of pushing methadone and Suboxone as far as alternatives to 12-step, and as well as 12-step. And then I also worked with a program working with women that had been sexually trafficked down in Burien to do chemical dependency groups for women. And so I think it was just kind of the natural progression of my interest in how do I serve these clients. And then from there, I made my way into plant medicine advocacy because I felt like I was being such a tool of the system and wasn't really helping my clients because, as you know, 12% has maybe like a 6% to 10% success rate. And I'm not dissing 12-step, but I think I had fallen into the Gabor Mate crowd, and I was yearning for ayahuasca or ibogaine or Bufo or psilocybin, other forms of plant medicine treatment that were showing more efficacy. And particularly I was working with indigenous populations. So I felt like at the end there, I felt just this huge sense of disconnect between, wow, these groups had kind of started off with plant medicines, and then you have colonization, right? And then you have the system, which says it's trying to help them, but a lot of times these people are experiencing recidivism rates that are exceptionally high. And just seeing the plague of fentanyl and trank on our streets of Seattle and the homeless population. Seattle's the third largest homeless population in the United States. I just kind of got fed up with being part of the system, so I decided to move outside the system.
Wow. I have to tell you how much I got out of Gabor Mate's book, In the Realm of the Hungry Ghost. He is such a deep thinker. He's really an amazing person. Also, coincidentally, Dr. Richard Talbot at the health board was my doctor for a while.
I know him.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's my favorite doctor I've ever had, believe it or not, in my whole life, and I've had a lot. I feel like half of America could benefit from a mental health therapist after the events of this week, and I say that only half jokingly. I realize that we could do this entire show on this question.
Yeah.
And I only touched the surface, and we'd still only touch the surface. But from your perspective, what connections lie between chemical dependency and mental health? It seems maybe obvious. Is it possible for you to boil down the complex relationship between the two?
Well, I mean, I think for most of us, we've watched enough TV or enough programs or have enough personal experience with those that we love that suffer from addiction, which we have such high rates in this country. I think there's a natural correlation that we see, whether you've been trained from a psychological background or you've been in the social service system. Maybe you've been trained as a social worker and that kind of thing, or maybe you're self-educated. But I think most of the public has some awareness that there's a direct correlation between addiction and early childhood trauma, even more so with sexual trauma, that there's almost like a 95%, I think, correlation between early childhood sexual trauma and addiction.
And esteem and self-image and all that's all kind of all wrapped up in a big ball, right?
Yep.
In a society that is traumatic for anybody paying a lot of close attention, right, on some level, the average person might find it counterintuitive for an addiction specialist to be working to legalize psychedelics or entheogens. Can you talk about your motivations for your organizing and advocacy for policy reform relating to psychedelic substances?
Yeah,
and then we'll get into the actual nuts and bolts.
Sure. So my son was 18, I think, when I finally came out of the closet officially. And so for me, I had gone through a really difficult custody battle, and I knew that my ex would use anything against me that he could. And because of that, and because I worked for the government, and there was safety in working for the government, if you're a CPS worker, if you're working on the front lines with the police, if you're working as the professional, as the person who can deem someone else to have the problem, right, then you're in a position of power and control and authority. And what I witnessed for myself was that I decided to take the big leap. I decided to leave that position of being working for the government, for the state, for the county, in positions of authority where I got to go into jails, I got to go into mental hospitals. I could, you know, have a pass to basically go anywhere. As a CPS worker, I could, you know, come into your home, you know, just a lot of power. And I gave all that up. And I think part of it was that my son was old enough that I knew the system well enough to know that, you know, people can use the system. They can say that you're a drug user if you use plant medicine, even though for the most part, I had just been involved with a legal ayahuasca church in the United States called the Santo Daime. So I was federally protected. But I wasn't willing to kind of expose myself like that. And also, I think I didn't want to lose the credibility that I had working. I had gained a lot of respect working to help get people out of incarcerations and like hospitalizations for like a murder that they maybe did at 19, but spent 52 years for one of my clients in the state mental hospital. And to get these men out felt so significant to me. It was hard to leave the rush of that because I got so many applause for that. And I feel like I've gotten less applause as a psychedelic leader, but it just to follow my heart, I just had to get out of the system and be part of a solution to get things to people faster. There wasn't enough that was happening that was fast enough. And I just felt like if you care about people, then slapping on Band-Aids at a certain point, even though the paycheck might be good, the authority might feel great, I just think you can kind of have an existential dilemma within your own soul to kind of realize, like, where do you want to spend the remaining years of your life?
Right. And I think, you know, in a country with a catastrophic addiction crisis raging, it'd be hard to say that traditional methods have been effective. Is that a fair statement?
I would say they've caused almost more harm than good as far as how we've implemented them when you do forced treatment. I've just seen so many of my clients where I feel like I'm preaching to people that just won't listen, that you need to have people's buy-in. If you're forcing treatment on people, most of the treatment I did at Seattle Indian Health Board was forced treatment, you know, for people that were getting out of incarceration, and it was mandatory that they attend groups and be assessed weekly to see if their UAs were clean and so forth. If you have an authority figure for people who struggle with authority figures, maybe they had an abusive father, what have you, that can be incredibly triggering. So a lot of these folks are just set up for failure, I believe, because I know that I struggle with authority, and you probably, you know, struggle with authority. And when people try to tell me they're helping me, but they're scrutinizing my urine and they're looking for me to fail, they're expecting for me to fail, and they're making my treatment only one road. There's not multiple roads. I don't get to choose the road, but the road is mandatory. Then, you need to have a choice in the process or you're not going to be motivated to change.
And it's kind of obscene to have forced treatment without treatment on demand, right? All right, we need to go to the first break. We're going to come right back with Leo Russell from the Entheo Society.
Time to roll out for the people that let us hemp present. Hang loose. We're coming right back.
Back with Leo Russell. Leo, your organization has a therapeutic bill project for psilocybin that you are aiming for the next legislative session here in Washington State. Can you tell me about that and ways that people can support the effort?
Sure. You can go to adaptbill.org, adaptbill.org. That's a website that we just got going. You can donate. We need about $150,000 by the end of November to move forward with the next legislative session. And I'm currently working with a big donor who may give, you know, a substantial amount to get us to the to that next legislative session as far as, like, what we're aiming for, which would be early 2025. But, you know, I'm feeling empowered and excited about it. We just had the largest psychedelic fair in Washington State's history in downtown Seattle. And, you know, there were probably a few people there that were feds, you know. Just feeling like encouraging volunteers. Every day I get contacted by new volunteers. And as you know, as an organizer, it can get exhausting. And so sometimes you need to take a day for yourself. But, yeah.
What would the bill do?
Well, it's very similar to 109 in Oregon in that it's just therapeutic psilocybin. It's what the state legislature would be willing to pass. 2 years ago, Solomon tried to get it going, and I felt like it wasn't a very well-articulated and honed messaging. I wasn't in charge of that particular effort. So I'm partnering with Senator Solomon and others. But, yeah, my effort is very similar to 109 in Oregon, which provides psilocybin centers where you would go. In Oregon, you have to be 18 years and above to be trained as basically like a trip sitter. You know, you can glorify it with different names, but it's someone that's been trained. I think it's like 2,000 hours of training, and you're getting certified to sit with people, and people are usually cleared ahead of time. You know, they're not people that are experiencing psychosis. There's clearly people that do not benefit from psychedelics, and then there's like a protocol of like a follow-up session or two. To just kind of ground people in their experiences. For some people who haven't tried psychedelics, it can be a very mind-opening, soul-opening experience. But sometimes we experience remembering something like a childhood trauma, and we may need some additional therapy to kind of process that.
Right, right. As you know, I did Seattle Hemp Fest for decades here in Seattle, and one of the things that we tried to do was make activism fun for people, you know.
Yeah.
Make it exciting and fun and trendy and mm-hmm. all of that stuff. And you are planning a Bollywood dance party fundraiser for your bill in the coming months.
Yep.
Can you tell us what that's about and what support you might need for that?
Yeah. So currently we're hoping.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
To get a spot donated, but if we don't, we have about a $5,000 price tag for the Nordic Museum in Ballard. And part of that is, like, sometimes we forget the aesthetics of beauty, but sometimes beauty, like you guys doing the Hemp Fest in a beautiful downtown location with all this modern art around you, you know, the impact of beauty cannot be, like, overemphasized. So just really looking forward to a fun evening. And I had lived in India as a kid for part of my childhood and just really love and connect with Bollywood culture and Bollywood dancing. And when you think, and if you ever go to a Bollywood event, it's very fun and it's very, it feels very joyous. And there's a lot of like group dancing and things like that. And right now where Seattle is kind of like one of those liberal pockets of the United States, experiencing a lot of depression over the vote, having those dark winter months where seasonal affective disorder is actually quite real, It's really an opportunity when you think about a lot of Indians aren't celebrating Christmas. So we're hoping to do it like right before Christmas. But and just those same things you mentioned, how do we capitalize on joy and how do we capitalize on including other cultures in the psychedelic movement? We had a lot of Indians because there's a pretty large immigrant Indian population in the Seattle Bellevue area. We had a lot of Indians that came to our psychedelic fair and expressed so much curiosity and so much interest and wanting to learn. And so when you think about the culture of India and its impact on, the Beatles, the hippie movement, the beatniks, like transcendentalism in general, as it relates to Hinduism, there's a lot of overlay. So I think it's about celebrating other cultures. I really feel like sometimes we get so in our little groups that we don't look around often enough to say, hey, it seems like we're pretty much like middle-class white ladies. You know what I mean? Like, what happened here, you know?
Right. That makes a lot of sense. My wife's got large connections to the Indian community here, having spent decades in India, and she goes to the temple and stuff. So I'll talk to her about that.
Yeah.
A lot of recent drug policy reforms have been driven by citizen ballot initiatives, such as your 2016 initiative effort.
Yep.
No voter-based initiative has been on the ballot since 2016.
That's correct.
Because as you told me, it takes $2 to $7 million to get on the ballot, because our state government charges as much as $10 per signature to vet each signature. What's up with all that? What's your thoughts on all that?
So I think, they just got really protective about we're letting Tim Iman, who historically in Washington State was a Republican who kept pushing things on the ballot.
A grifter approach.
Well, he was so successful, really, that they said, hold your horses, buddy. And so they created enough just the internal process for getting a voter-based initiative on the ballot has now been circumvented in such a way that it's really such a high, mark to meet in terms of raising the money for that. And I think that what that speaks to is kind of a lack of democracy as far as the voters in Washington State. I recently had someone who's helping us with the bill effort say to me that someone, I forget the health committee that kind of handles these kinds of things for Washington State, but that woman who's a Democrat is not in favor of a bill effort and would rather see a voter-based initiative. Even though she's a Democrat, she's not leaning towards drug legalization in any way. And that's unfortunate. I don't know if it's because Big Pharma is, one of her donors, but she just clearly isn't interested in the bill effort and kind of said nonchalantly, let's let the voters do this. Maybe not realizing that voters have not been able to.
That is letting the voters do it.
Right, but that voters haven't successfully been able to raise the funds to do things independently since 2016.
Right. And of course, Tim Iman was really kind of taking a libertarian approach, and he was successful at reducing funding, right, for the state from their high tabs fees and stuff like that. They're probably trying to set the bar real high, right?
Definitely. And I just think it speaks to there has to be some kind of middle ground for voters to initiate things on their own, because as you know, public policy is often dictated by donors who can give to legislators.
Yeah. And more so than ever, as we just saw. We have about 3 minutes till the next break. In the corporate sector, there's a concept called the glass ceiling that refers to the unbalanced power relationship between men and women in the business world, and men dominate much of the corporate world, but thankfully that's changing. Mm-hmm. The same gender disparity exists in cannabis. I've heard it called the grass ceiling. And today there's a growing psychedelic movement, and Shazam, here we go again. As you were telling me, RFK Jr. had a psychedelic platform. Elon Musk openly talks about ketamine therapy. Joe Rogan has the largest podcast in the world, and he's open about it. Even Tucker Carlson boasts about his days hanging out with Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. Where are the women in media or politics getting profile exposure regarding entheogens? Tell us your opinions on all that.
Yeah, I mean, my opinion's a bit harsh in that I feel like if women are kind of whiny, we've kind of, as a culture, turned our eyes or ears away from, like, the whiny, angry cat lady, unfortunately, which may then cause a whiny, angry cat lady revolution, you know, just lurking in the shadows. But I do feel like we have a problem with, we have these kind of cool bro club kind of dudes on the podcast that are all hip with the psychedelics. We don't see that with women. We don't see the eccentric kind of autistic genius that Elon Musk is, that's kind of goofy and self-effacing. We don't kind of get to see those roles with women. In psychedelics, we tend to highlight the healers and, like, the mamas, the mothers that are there to kind of do the healing circles or the gong circles or whatever. And so I want to highlight myself, even though that sounds narcissistic, because I just don't see other role models like me. And it's not like I wanted to break, like, this glass ceiling. It's not like it's a lot of fun, but I just am not seeing those role models out there, just to be completely frank.
Right, right. And yeah, women deserve to have that connection, right, with the entheogen community. As much as men do, and they have just as much to gain.
Right. Well, I just think the politics of psychedelics is for everyone. It's not gender based, and it's not like only men are having deep contemplative journeys in psychedelics.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's an understatement. We're going to go to another break and come back with our final segment.
Time to roll out for the people that let us have present. Hang loose. We're coming right back.
We are back for our final segment with Leo Russell. Leo, we just had an explosive, ground-shifting, tectonic national election with a balance of power shifting to a degree that's really unprecedented in modern politics. The dust is literally still settling, but a massive ideological shift looms on the horizon, with the fringes of our society are likely to survive unscathed. Massachusetts voters just resoundingly rejected a ballot initiative to decriminalize psychedelic drugs and legalize therapeutic use. Had it been successful on election day, question four would have decriminalized personal use, possession, home cultivation, and uncompensated distribution of psilocybin, psilocin, mescaline, ibogaine, DMT. And it would have created a regulatory structure for psychedelic assisted therapy at licensed facilities. Massachusetts would have been the third state to approve similar reforms by ballot after Oregon in 2020 and Colorado in 2022. And question four is really well funded. What do you think happened? And are you concerned about the impacts of the election of Donald Trump, who has an apparent mandate for right-wing governance? Are you concerned about any kind of an effect on entheogen reform?
Well, I am. What I've said to kind of my hippie psychedelic crowd folks is, like, you know, guys, we have a problem, and I'm feeling a little bit unheard in that. And the reason is that I lead a bipartisan effort for my bill and initiative efforts. So I'm working with conservatives, I'm working with libertarians, I'm working with everyone. So I don't get to have the luxury of preaching my own political perspective, other than I'm here for the bipartisan plant medicine movement. And where I'm struggling now is that I watch a lot of conservative TV because I try to get ahead of, like, well, what are conservatives thinking? How are they feeling? What are they doing? If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so what I said about a month ago was that you do have these people like RFK Jr. who do have a plan, it sounds like, to do something with psychedelics, and that's great. They may allow clinical trials of ibogaine, which would be fantastic. But where I think they dropped the ball in Massachusetts, and I went to college at Simon's Rock College of Bard in Massachusetts near Pittsfield when I was 16, so I'm real familiar with the vibe of Massachusetts. But they didn't do enough to do outreach with those rural communities. And in the same fashion, 109 in Oregon, they reversed some of the 109 counties that had legalized psilocybin therapy because the conservatives, I think, just didn't feel like they were consulted. You know, they just felt like kind of like the liberal elite were, pushing it down their throats. So I think this speaks to more of that bipartisan, how do you get conservatives out there speaking to conservatives about psychedelics? You know, how do you get Elon Musk and Joe Rogan and Tucker Carlson or whoever, Sean Ryan maybe, to get out there and be that voice of conservatives and psychedelics and make those outreaches? But what I've told folks about a month ago was that there's a gentleman, I forget his name, but he's like a snazzy, kind of articulate, conservative young man that was kind of a pundit for Trump on the campaign trail. And he was out there, Vivian, and correlating kind of like our homeless opioid epidemic in these major cities directly with drug legalization. So kind of lumping all of these drugs together.
Kind of a culture war, a culture
right,
war.
Right. Thing. And what I said to folks is you need to get out ahead of this because you need to direct the narrative back to a conversation that distinguishes how psychedelics are different, how they help, how they can help heal us, how Parkinson's research with Ibogaine is amazing and groundbreaking. So we really need to get someone out there, and I'd love to be that person unless someone else wants to like fight me for it, but I'd love to be that person that gets out on Joe Rogan and says, I'll be the face of the political psychedelic movement. We need to be what that gentleman was, what that conservative guy was doing, which was he was explaining to the crowds, why are your cities messed up? It's because of these liberals with their drug legalization, and that's right. Wrong. So we need right. someone out there to say, this is not wrong. Let's distinguish between the drugs that we're talking about and do some basic drug education.
We are running out of time in about 30 seconds. What are your final thoughts you want to leave us with?
I'm excited. I'm nervous. I'm worried, but I'm excited because I want to be the bridge. I want to bring the liberals together that are hurting right now. I want to bring together the women that are grieving the fact that some of them will never see a woman president in their lifetime. This is a very emotional issue for a lot of women. And I think we need to show respect for that and respond to that as a country. I pray for us all. Thank
you. All right. That's a great place to leave it. Really quickly, is there a URL? People can learn more.
I don't know right offhand. www.adaptbill.org.
Perfect. Leo Russell, thank you for all your important work, and thanks for being on Hemp Present.
Thank you, Vivian. You're amazing.
All right, back at you. The Hemp Presents intro music is Take Back the Plant by Stickerbush, and the outro music is 7 Mile Beach by Joanne Rand. Hang in there, folks.
Marijuana! Sweet sativa, take your dream. Since me, built a nine. Smoke the ganja.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.